Hello and welcome to Patron Deities, a show about deities for my patrons. I'm James Holloway and I'm studying the myths and religions of the world, and as I do, I'm looking for inspiration in them for fantasy role-playing games. In today's episode, we're continuing our journey through Haitian voodoo, the syncretic religion that combines West African influences with French Catholicism and other influences to create a new religion that is, many people would say, the national religion of Haiti. In our last episode, we took a look at the history and culture of Haiti, and in this episode, we're going to look specifically at the experience of voodoo. Specifically, we're going to focus on the temples and societies that sustain voodoo. As always, I have to put forward a couple of disclaimers. First, I'm learning about this as I go, but one of the things that I've definitely learned is that there is a wide amount of variety in the way that voodoo is practiced. And in particular, I think there seems to be a lot of variety between the way that it is practiced in the Haitian countryside and the way it's practiced in cities. So it's very possible that what I'm going to say applies mainly to kind of how things are done in Port-au-Prince and that it might be different elsewhere. Also, as always, there's a good chance I'll mispronounce some Haitian Creole terms. Now, for this episode only, I have to add the disclaimer that I was away the past weekend. I was at a LARP event. I play in a live-action role-playing game where the system involves a lot of spoken communication, and in a busy, you know, combat environment, that means shouting. So as you can hear, My voice is not great. Although, having said that, I don't think it's really shouting. It's the, like, staying up late after hours, catching up with friends that does it. It's the chat rather than the game itself. But my point is simply that my voice is not his usual self, and this episode might not be quite as long as a typical episode. I'm not sure. We'll find out. Sort of all depends on the editing. So let's talk about the priesthood of voodoo and the shrines or temples of voodoo. So first up, priesthood. There is a very clearly recognized role of priest or priestess in voodoo. Hungans, if they're men, or Mambo, if they are women. These are the heads of typically a temple, a hanfo, and sometimes you'll just hear them called papa or mama, dad or mom. This is an initiatory role for the most part. It's the culmination of a long process of initiation through different grades. Accounts vary, but one common number seems to be that there are four different grades of initiation. And usually you are taught by another Hungan or another Mambo. This isn't always exactly true. You can also be initiated magically. So there are people who will claim that they have been away and that they have been being taught by the Loa themselves. Specifically, that they've been being taught under the ocean or under the water. Sometimes it's river water. But water and the ocean in particular, in the symbolism of voodoo, often has this otherworldliness to it. This idea that the ocean ties back to the ancestral land of, you know, deities or land of ancestors. And that's called Guinea sometimes, Africa, Guinea. But I don't think it has much to do with, like, the literal physical place. It's a heavenly realm. So in this case, yeah, you can be initiated, like, under the water. There are certain law that commonly do this, but normally I would say that you are initiated by another Mambo or Hungan. And that initiation is a commercial transaction. To some extent, like, the process is expensive, and you pay not only for the education that you receive, but also for, like, the materials, for all the various rites that you have to go through in order to complete the initiation. And this is true of a lot of things that the Mambo or Hongkong do, because, like a lot of religions, voodoo lacks any kind of, well, it doesn't lack. I don't know that it feels like it's missing it, but it doesn't have one. A centralized structure or hierarchy. There's no voodoo pope. There's no voodoo authorities, really. There's no single sacred text. There's just a body of what they call connaissance, a body of spiritual knowledge. And there's traditions. But if you are running a hanfo, then there's kind of nowhere to go up. There's not someone above you. The relationships between initiator and initiand are unequal, but I don't know that they're hierarchical. And congregations who don't like how a hongon is running things, you know, there is a certain virtue made of loyalty or consistency dealing with a particular hongfo community. But ultimately, I think if people don't like how things are going in a particular hongfo, they might just leave. Not as simple as all that. And so the hongon or mambo who runs a temple is essentially its proprietor and brings in resources to the hongfo in a number of ways, some of which we'll talk about later, some of which are just things like receiving gifts or offerings in exchange for doing things like healing or counseling. One thing that's very interesting to me about the hongfo as an institution is that the sort of collective body of hongfos generally is not structured. There's no hierarchy, there's no rank. One is formally, at least, as good as the next. But within the temple, there is a high degree of stratification. There are officials and layers of insiders and outsiders. So we have all of the people who regularly attend service at the hongfo, and we can call them, you know, it's community, it's congregation. Within that, we have a sort of inner circle. These are the hongsi. These are community members who have committed to serving the temple, and they do tasks like cleaning and repairing it, or participating in the dances and songs that are important parts of ceremonies. I've read some sources that say that hongsi are mostly, but not exclusively, women, and I've read others that say that it's 50-50, so that makes me think that it's just different depending on where you are or when you are. These, of course, are also sources that are separated chronologically. It's common for hongsi on ceremonial occasions to dress in white. You often see these voodoo ceremonies taking place where these women in kind of white dresses or white robes with white headscarves, and those are hongsi. Now, among the hongsi, there are a number of specific officers. The list that Metro presents includes jobs like the, and I don't know if I'm pronouncing this correctly, the hongzhenikang, also called the Ren Chanterelle. Ren Chanterelle suggests that this is the choir mistress. So there's the person who heads up the choir. Singing is a very important part of a voodoo ritual. The Ren Chanterelle is also in charge of other aspects of the rite. So basically kind of the impression I get is that this is sort of the supervisor of the hongsi during their participation in the rites. We've also got the Hongzhenikang La Place, sometimes just called the La Place for short, or various other, you know, commandant de la place. There's a lot of kind of military terminology or military structure in voodoo, and it's been suggested that this comes from the kind of like nationalistic, militaristic fervor that existed in Haiti in the period immediately following, or indeed during and following, the Haitian Revolution. Anyway, the Hongzhenikang La Place, or the La Place, or the quartermaster, is responsible for dealing with the offerings. Offerings, particularly food offerings, but also libations, you know, offerings of clara, which is a sugarcane liquor related to rum, or money, or whatever, right? There are lots of offerings that can be made to the loi during a ceremony, and making sure that they're done smoothly, like that the stuff is there to be offered, or, you know, disposing of what is received. That's the job of the La Place. The confiance is in charge of the administration of the temple. And speaking of administration, many hongfo are supported by what's called a société soutien. That would mean a support society. These are people who I don't think are hongsi. They're just members of the congregation, and they are kind of the patrons of the hongfo, and they essentially pay dues or subscriptions, you know, either regularly or as the need arises, to support the temple. They're a sort of lay auxiliary, and I don't get the impression that they consist of every lay worshiper who attends that temple. They seem to be a little bit more special than that. Of course, perhaps not all worshippers could afford to support the hongfo in that way. I mentioned the idea that voodoo is an initiatory faith, that there are different grades of initiation. These initiation processes can be quite long. It's not like you just go to some rite, and then after that, you're of the new rank. They're quite prolonged processes, not just the sort of education that you have to receive, but also the rites themselves. They include periods of isolation or seclusion, dreaming, teaching to build up the initiate's connaissance, ritual cleansings. So there's quite a lot that goes on. And I mention this in connection to these other things because I think it shows the ways in which these relationships between the individual or between the community and the Hanfo are ongoing over a long period. This is a very involved, or it can be anyway, a very involved relationship. Now, I don't know that the typical Fuduizan like goes into all this initiation and these sort of, you know, or is this for more devoted participants? You might have to go through a lot before you get your asan, the ceremonial rattle that marks out a member of the Vodou priesthood. The temple building itself, you can vary a lot depending on where you are. It's often, but not always, attached to a residence. And my understanding is that in the countryside, it was traditionally more a complex of buildings. And that in the city, what used to be sort of different buildings within a compound are now different rooms within the same building. But the most important room in the ceremonial aspect of voodoo, at least, is a main ceremonial space called a peristyle. And the peristyle has a decorated central pillar, often painted, called a potomiton. And the potomiton is thought of as the spiritual connection through which the Lwa descend to manifest during ceremonies. It's traditional, although not universal, for the peristyle to have an earth floor. One reason for this is so that when libations are poured on the ground, they'll just be soaked up. Other rooms within buildings within the Hanfo have specific other roles, such as storage for sacred artifacts, or for the, this is not the correct term, but I sort of feel like it's a little bit like that. Maybe this is because I was a theater props guy in high school, but I feel like the props and costumes, which is to say the various artifacts and sacred vestments, but in voodoo, these can look quite splendid and almost sort of theatrical. These spatial elements, the presence of a peristyle and a potomiton and so on, across different Hanfos are very similar, but they're not identical. And this is something that I think can be fun in games, which is to have a particular spatial logic and a way of reading that. In the same way that two late medieval halls or high medieval halls don't have to actually be identical, but one can still understand or can kind of read the layout of the thing, even though you're not familiar with this specific instance of it. So thinking about how to adapt this to a game, as always, the social context episodes take a little bit more effort, but I think that the thing that really stands out to me is the existence of these grades of initiation and, you know, levels of participation among the community in a temple. Because I think we're used to, or at least I am used to thinking of, a congregation as having a very small group of specialists at its head, and then a very large group of largely undifferentiated congregants. So, old Mrs. McGillicuddy, who's been coming here for 30 years, that grants her, like, some kind of special status in the church, but it doesn't necessarily give her any kind of official status. Maybe it does, I don't know. I'm sure there are a lot of Mrs. McGillicuddies who are important in things like volunteering or whatever. But I do think that this is something that doesn't come up very much in fantasy RPGs. Again, returning to my previous thing about how in RPGs, the only people who are at all religious are priests. But I think it could be a lot of fun to have characters who were part of this network of societies and hierarchies and so forth surrounding a religious institution. You know, maybe we're talking about NPCs in like a murder mystery scenario here, where that's kind of how the suspects all know each other. But maybe it's the PCs. You know, it could be that you have a cleric character where, like, you know, the reports they're getting from their contact or whatever, it's someone they know from their Société Soutien, or it could be that that is how the player characters met, that they're all members of the same religious community, even if they're not from cleric or paladin or similar classes. A slightly different version of this could be found in medieval guilds, which often had strong associations with a particular church, would often contribute financially to the upkeep of that church, but which today I don't think we think of as religious societies, even though religion was an important part of their raison d'être. I think that having structured communities that have both sacred and lay elements in them is a really interesting idea. It would be a lot of fun to kind of flesh out those NPCs and have them be part of the cleric's life, as opposed to only ever having the cleric deal with members of a religious hierarchy. I also think it would be a lot of fun for the cleric to be effectively a small business person. So if you think about a Hongkong in Haitian voodoo, he's not drawing a salary from the Central Church of Voodoo because there isn't one. Instead, he is effectively in business for his own hunfo. Just superficially, you know, on an outsider's perspective, it seems to me that, like a lot of very poor cultures, Haiti does not have the prohibitions against mixing business with other things that more well-off cultures can sometimes have, presumably because there's no alternative. If you're going to devote your whole life to the loi, you know, and spend all day preparing for the rites and getting all the stuff that you need for them and rehearsing the various songs and prayers, then realistically, you need a source of support. And that doesn't mean that you're selling out or blaspheming. That's not something that would occur to a voodooism, because it's just kind of, you know, you've got to make a living. There's nothing abnormal about it. And I do think that that's an interesting look for the cleric. In particular, one that could motivate a cleric to go out and raise money, you know, if times are hard at the temple, through a side career, like, say, adventuring. And again, throughout history, this hasn't been so uncommon, this idea that members of a religious, I mean, elite's the wrong word, but members of a group of religious initiates might necessarily have to find somewhere else to work in order to make ends meet. You know, if you're not drawing a salary from the Church of Pelor, well, you got to go out and get a job like everybody else. So I think in many cases, the importance of money to voodoo actually in some ways makes it like the money requirements of voodoo. There are certain law that like being given gifts of money, or will haggle, or will even lend money. That makes a lot of sense if you think about it, because these are communities that tend to have a somewhat hard-headed, pragmatic view of those matters. And if a god wants offerings of food, and if a god wants offerings of service, then why wouldn't a god want offerings of money, a thing that can famously be exchanged for goods and services? Again, this returns me to the thing I said earlier about how I'm not trying to replicate Haitian voodoo in a role-playing game. Instead, I'm trying to, by looking at Haitian voodoo, think about concepts of religious structure and religious belief that would be fun to replicate in RPGs. Having said that, next week we're going to take a look at a couple of deities from, I don't want to say pantheon, that doesn't sound quite right, but a couple of loi, and we're going to look at Grand Met, the god that sits over all of them and kind of doesn't do all that much. So I hope that you will join me then on Patron Deities, a show about deities for my patrons. Thank you for listening, and thank you very much for supporting Monster Man on Patreon.